We're in 1 Timothy chapter 5, and I think we read all the way up through verse 16 last week. I don't know if we covered everything there, but I was trying to remember exactly where we ended off last week. Why don't we just take the section from verse 11 down to verse 16, and we'll just go over that, and then maybe we'll get into the next section here on elders. Again, if you want to outline this chapter or want to put this chapter in some kind of framework, verses 3 to 16 deal specifically with widows and the church, and with ministry to widows. And then you can break that down, sub-break that down. Verses 3 through 8, widows and families. And the dynamics there, and then widows in the church. So big heading, verses 3 to 16, ministry to widows, and then a subheading, widows and families 3 to 8, widows in the church 9 to 16. And we're in that second half, widows in their relationship to the church. So beginning in verse 11, refuse to put younger widows on the list, for when they feel sensual desire in disregard to Christ, they want to get married, thus incurring condemnation because they have set aside their previous pledge. At the same time, they also learn to be idle, and they go around from house to house, and not merely idle, but also gossips and busybodies, talking about things not proper to mention. Therefore, I want younger widows to get married, bear children, keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach. For some have already turned aside to follow Satan. If any woman who is a believer has dependent widows, she must assist them, and the church must not be burdened, so that it may assist those who are widows indeed. Okay. Now, I believe we talked about the qualifications for widows, how people get qualified to get on this list, and this is a list of support. I think we talked about verse 10 or 11? Okay. All right. So looking at it, we talked about hospitality to strangers, I think, about welcoming people in, we talked about the saints, washing the saints' feet, assisting those in distress. Notice all the different things this lady who is going to be supported by the church is engaged in verse 10. And these are all just different qualifications for getting put on this list where the church is literally supporting you as a widow. And I think there are eight or more in this section. But what do you think about Paul's suggestion here? What are some advantages of using these kinds of qualifying tests before you put somebody on a list for support? Whenever you have a policy in place, a series of rules, it takes the emotion, like you say, out of the decision, doesn't it? I mean, haven't we all seen the pictures of the children who are starving on the television, or the old people in Russia who are starving, and if you will just please send. Of course, if you want to be a rotten person and not send, the kid's going to starve. But, you know, if you, and there's something about that kind of appeal that most people don't like. They feel kind of like the arm was twisted behind the back. And in a church, what could be more needy than a widow coming in and saying, "Can you please help me?" And the tendency would be many times to do what? Or respond out of emotion, you know, and because you know, she's this pitiful character, and of course, Paul says there are all these qualifications. It takes out that element of a decision based on emotion. It's purely on emotion. And a lot of the appeals you get over the media, a lot of the things I get in my email box are like that. Show you a picture of a starving kid, and you know, and if you don't do something, this child's going to die. Well, there is a certain truth to that. We all know that's true. But at the same time, does that mean that God wants us to go home and empty our refrigerator and ship the canned goods over there? You know, there's a sense in which God has a work for us to do. He points it out to us. He speaks to our hearts. And Jesus said, the poor you'll always have with you. You can help them whenever you want. It's better to make these decisions about giving based on some rational thought and by being led by the Holy Spirit. Otherwise, what happens if you constantly appeal from an emotional, from your emotions? And when you get drained, and then when you get drained, then this is kind of a response. I'm burnt out. I'm done with this. I'm never going to answer another one of these appeals. Yeah. That's the downside of not being logical about it, thoughtful about it. how important is this kind of ministry, the helping of widows, in a church and in a community? How important would you say it is? Mm-hmm. What's one reason why it's very important? Yeah. It validates a gospel of love and care. We say we are the people who love our enemies. We forgive those, you know, those who wrong. We say we're following Jesus, and Jesus helped the poor. Well, one of the ways we prove that out, we demonstrate that, is by helping the less fortunate, the widows. And widows in this society would have been those particularly in need. I think we talked about the history that one of the biggest problems faced by the early church was that of orphans and widows. The more things change, the more they remain the same. Why was that? Well, a lot of the parents, don't forget, were executed. Parents were killed. There was persecution, you know. Today, a lot of widows are created, and a lot of orphans are created by the AIDS epidemic. I mean, Uganda's full of widows and orphans because so many people have died because of AIDS. You know, South Africa, too. So this, again, it's a recurrent thing that the church has always had to address. And widows, I think we said, have a high priority in God's economy. God puts a priority in helping widows and orphans. All right, well, let's go on to verse 11. This is one of the disadvantages of adding somebody to the widow's list. What might be some of the disadvantages, as Paul points out in verse 11? What's the downside of putting widows on a list where the church supports them and they don't have to go out and get a regular job? Time on your hands. And all those old proverbs come to mind. The devil's mind, you know, idle mind is the devil's workshop. Yeah, yeah. Does he restrict it, or does he give you any particular categories of widows? Younger widows. Yeah. And remember, we said Paul earlier said 60 years old and upwards. You know. So one of the guidelines to follow for the church in helping widows would be, according to this verse anyway, but a younger person, guidelines necessary in a positive and negative sense. What kind of influences are affecting people in a younger age group? What kind of influences might be affecting a young widow? What do we see today in single parent families everywhere?
Their sexual desire, so they can worry more about their relationship than they are their loneliness or whatever.
Yeah. A lot of the sexual abuse of children, domestic abuse of women, is because the person abusing them is not the husband. He's the boyfriend. Maybe he's the third boyfriend, or the fifth boyfriend, or the sixth boyfriend. He has no emotional connection with the children. He just has an emotional connection with the woman. And so, what is Paul's corrective to this, or what does... What does he say is true about these ladies? What will they disregard? Or who will they disregard? Yeah. Now, remember, these are people in the church, you know. So there's a certain pragmatism to this approach, isn't there? Paul does not ignore the physical realities that people have drives. They have desires at different stages of their life. They're motivated by different things. It's a realistic approach to people. The word here that he uses for sensual desire is a rare word. It combines two different ideas, the idea of desire and rebellion. Rebellion against Christ, the one to whom they have committed themselves. Younger women, widows who are put on the list, remember what the widows are going to do. They're going to help in the church. They're going to do different things, have ministries of good works. Younger widows who were put on the list would not want to be bound by church responsibilities and duties at an age when marriage was still a real option for them. This word for sensual desire is also the word that's used to describe the city of Babylon in Revelation 18. Where it says, all the nations have drunk the wine of the passion of Babylon, of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of morality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. Another place where you see this word, this word is translated sensual desire here, is in Ezekiel 16, verse 49. It says, this was the sin of thy sister Sodom, pride. She and her daughters, and this is the word, lived in pleasure, in fullness of bread and in abundance. This belonged to her and her daughters, and they helped not the hand of the poor and needy. So one of the things that goes with living sensually or satisfying your own desires is a corresponding forgetting of the needs of the well-being of the needy, and not extending your hand. People oftentimes think the reason God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah was because of their sexual perversion. Well, that was only part of it. Another reason why God destroyed them was because they were ignoring the poor. They were not helping the poor. They were abusing the poor and taking advantage of the poor. So a younger woman in this category would want, her focus is not going to be on Christ, it's going to be on getting married again. That's generally what she's going to be focused on. Mm-hmm. Right. The thing is, again, it gets back to what is her focus and what is she aimed at? You know, impulse. Right, exactly. And if you put her on the list, like we just said, she's not going to have to go out and earn a living, so she's going to have free time. You know, and she may be a dedicated person, but all people, various stages in our lives, we're under different influences. And your tendency when you're younger is she's going to want to meet somebody and settle down and get married. So it says here in verse 12 that she will do what? She will, and this is sometimes a difficult verse. What happens if she disregards Christ? Yeah. And why does she come? The word condemnation here means a judgment, a judicial verdict against, a judgment against. It's what Jesus said to the scribes and the Pharisees in Luke chapter 20, verse 47, where it says, they devour women's widows' houses and for appearance sake offer long prayers. They will receive greater condemnation. It's the same word, condemnation. In Romans chapter 2, verse 2, it's the same kind of thing. We know that the judgment or the condemnation of God falls rightly upon those who practice such things. And he gives a long list of sins there. She will come under condemnation. Why does she come under condemnation? According to verse 12, anyway. There's been a setting aside of some kind of a pledge. Well, what is a pledge? Pledge is another way of saying a vow, an oath. Well, obviously, it can't be her marriage oath because her husband's gone. But what other vow, what other oath may she have made? Scholars are kind of, that's one track of the way they look at this, is that this is her commitment to Christ that she's setting aside. Others say that in that first century, it was not uncommon for a widow, when she married again, to adopt the faith of her new husband. So if she marries an unbeliever, what is likely going to happen to her own faith? Does the Bible say anything about marrying unbelievers? Yeah. 1 Corinthians 6, where Paul says, don't be unequally yoked. You know, don't get into a relationship, a physical relationship, a married relationship with somebody who's not a believer. You know. Because what happens is, almost 9 times out of 10, that the believer's hindered in their faith. And not always, but sometimes the unbeliever becomes a Christian, but not all. But most oftentimes it's the other way around. I'm looking for that don't be unequally yoked verse. I think it's 6. It's the passage that says, he joins himself to the Lord, becomes one with him. The danger, of course, is she's going to fall in love with somebody who's not a believer, and she's going to forsake her faith. And then if she's on the church roll, I can't find that verse. 17? Yeah. But one who joins himself to the Lord is one in spirit with him. And so, I wanted the one, though, that says that he don't be yoked with unbelievers. 2 Corinthians 6, okay. 6, wrong, right church, wrong pew, right? Okay. 14, yeah. Don't be bound together with unbelievers, for what partnership has righteousness and lawlessness, or what fellowship with light with darkness? What harmony has Christ with Belial, or what has a believer in common with unbeliever? Now, obviously, this doesn't mean we don't go to school with unbelievers, we don't go to restaurants with unbelievers, we don't go to baseball games with, no, it doesn't mean that. It means entering into a partnership, some kind of a partnership, a yoked partnership. Now, again, this sounds like common sense, but this is one of the persistent problems in the church. You have people who grow up in the church, they go out to school, and they meet somebody. And daddy or mommy, yeah, they come to church. I have a friend, this happened to her, went off to school, good Christian woman, met a guy. Yeah, he did all the Christian things and said all the Christian things when he met her because he wanted to marry her. That marriage lasted about 7-8 years. She's still in the church. He left. And because, you know, there again, you know, those fundamental relationships affect every area of your life. And if you get into an emotional relationship with someone who's not a believer, it's just not a good situation. You know, I know of a couple where the husband was not a Christian, the wife married him anyway, and he became a Christian. But that generally is not what happens oftentimes. It's like two horses and always in harness, and always one want to go one way and one want to go the other way, you know. So for younger people in the church, particularly youth, someone said the most critical decision after coming to Jesus you make in your life is who you marry. And if they get that one wrong, it's a biggie, you know. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Our emotions have a direct access to our heart, and whoever we are emotionally connected to has a profound effect on our lives. I know this is obvious, but it just needs to be said over and over and again. Again, the people in their 20s, 30s, in that marriageable age, when they're thinking about marriage, the best counsel they need to have is don't marry an unbeliever. Make sure the person you marry believes, is a real believer. Then that fits into this whole thing. She will come under condemnation because she set aside her previous pledge. Any other thoughts on that? Because this is a big issue, and it affects the church. It's continually affects the church. You know, parents who have marriageable age children, one of the best things you can do is do everything you can to convince your children not to marry an unbeliever. Yeah, it's it's a very painful way to live. I've done a lot of marriage counseling, and I can tell you one of the biggest things. Oftentimes, she wants to come to church, he doesn't. He won't come. I have to drag him, and it's like going through life with a ball and chain around your foot, and they're always resisting. I want to give some money to missions. Well, we need to spend that money on the new grill. It's like a constant pulling, you know, and that's a very unhappy kind of existence to have that on a regular basis, you know. Jesus said you can't love God and money, you know, and if you marry somebody who's in love with money, you know, it's a hard thing. Well, that's kind of, you could say a lot more about that, but let's go on. What is the correct, verse 13, this gets into more, his first main reason is to restrict this is because they're going to want to get remarried. What is his second main reason to restrict, to keep younger widows off the list of support? Desperate housewives, right?
Well, the
Notice what it is it says first about them in that verse. At the same time that they want to get married, what is happening at the same time? They're learning. This is the same word that is used for learning to be a disciple. In fact, it's the same word. It's where we get our word disciple from. They're learning, but what are they learning?
So in other
words, but it says that they are learning.
But I mean, by our support, we're enabling, they're learning because they're idle.
Yeah.
Learning to be idle.
See, the brain is an unusual organ in many respects, but one of the things that's true about everyone's brain is we will always be learning. You'll always be learning something. It's kind of like if you have a pile of dirt out there in the parking lot and you just leave it out there, it won't remain just a pile of dirt. In a few short weeks, what will you begin to see on that pile of dirt? Yeah. because there are all kinds of seeds flowing around everywhere. And they're just looking for a hospitable home to settle in. And anyone who is idle, who is not cultivation, then anything can plant there. They're becoming disciples of idleness, disciples of no work. I mean, you can think of the legions of people on public welfare. People who legitimately need it, maybe are disabled or have some other issues, but think of all the ones who are able-bodied. And it's bad enough that they're not contributing to society, but on the flip side, what else are they learning? They're learning to be idle. They become a permanent dependent class. We talk about the underclass now. They have generations. Kids don't even know what going to work is. Matthew 11, Jesus says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I am gentle and humble in heart. You'll find rest for your souls." James 2:22, when he talks about they become, learn to be idle, it's the same kind of a thought. But are you willing to recognize that faith without works is useless? It is unemployed. It is not producing anything. That's the same idea here. And learned behavior, what's the damage of the terrible thing about learned behavior? There's something good about learning things, and there's something bad about learning things. You know it, right? And behaviors that we learn, what are we likely to do with those behaviors? So you have adults who've learned bad behaviors teaching what? Not good behaviors, but bad behaviors to the next generation. And then it goes down. And that's why we have people slaughtering each other in Chicago. I mean, that's the explanation right there. It's not any more complicated than that. The whole idea of having a sense of conscience or valuing other people, it's not. They haven't been taught. They haven't learned it. Plus, you have the whole fallen nature of man. You know, this goes hand in hand. What else do these ladies do, or these people do? They go house to house. You just have a picture of, you know, you got a guy who's got a nice green lawn, no dandelions. You know, it's like they're walking around, blowing dandelion seeds all over it. It's like a disease. You know, we talk about the Zika virus. There's worse viruses than the Zika virus. This lifestyle becomes learned, and it just spreads. It's like a cancer or a disease. And the church, obviously, doesn't want to support that. We don't want to encourage that. They're not only idle, but what else do they do? Yeah. They learn to be gossips. Again, these are learned behaviors. There's something about a bit of gossip that is delicious, and it's seductive, and it's attractive. When you learn a secret about somebody, and only you know it, there's tremendous desire to do what? To repeat it. Because in the repeating, it gives us a sense of power, doesn't it? Have you heard about so-and-so? If you want to get people talking in a church, just get two people off to the side whispering to each other. And everybody said, "What are they whispering about?" You know, we all have to fight that tendency of staring in somebody else's living room window or bedroom window. And that's part of our fallen nature, you know. That's part of the attractiveness of sin. You know, they learn to be gossips and they learn to be busy bodies. You know, it means a person who is meddlesome, curious. There's nothing wrong with curiosity if you're curious about the right things. But there's something in the human nature that seems to love gossip. And I think it's because it gives us a sense of power over other people. Romans chapter 1, verses 28 to 30. And just as they did not see it fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do things which are not proper, being filled with unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God. He goes on, a long list there. One of the things the devil does is gossip. He slanders other people. That's what makes gossip so bad, because it's a slandering of someone else's character, someone else's reputation. And it can destroy a church. It can destroy a family. I mean, we see the wreckage all around us of people who became an illustration on the Sunday morning. You know, they had a marital problem or they had a family problem. That maybe the kid got messed up with drugs and the pastor comes up and says, I know a family. They shall remain nameless, but they live on 23 Maple Street in our very town. You know, I know there's a pastor at home, a church at home, Episcopal Church in Sparta, New Jersey. The pastor was sued. Marital trouble. Husband ran off with another man. And all he said on the Sunday morning was, please pray for this family. He got hauled into court. Sued the church. Defamation of character. This is a real problem in the church. The monks used to have a rule at their meals. You could only talk about somebody if they were present. How many conversations would that stop if we only talked about people who were present? It would shut down a lot of our conversations, I think. You know, it's an area of danger. So it's not just these ladies who are doing this. I think everyone is tempted to gossip. And it's so easy to go from talking to someone about a concern you have from somebody else to, you know, it always seems to go downhill. It's kind of like when you get a group of guys together at a meeting and someone will tell a joke and someone will tell a joke that's a little closer to the edge, and someone pretty soon you're right down there in the hogs. You're just in the muck and the mire, you know. That's our tendency because we have a fallen nature. Talking about things that are not proper to mention. What did James do? What did James say? And again, it's repeated in other places, James chapter 5. He says, 5 verse 20, let him know, or is it that? Is that the one I want? I'm looking for the verse that says, that's the one that turns a sinner from the error of his ways. But the one I wanted was it's Peter, I think. Love covers a multitude of sins. Keep fervent in your love for one. It's 1 Peter 4, I think. Keep fervent in your love for one another. Yeah, 1 Peter 4:8. Above all, keep fervent in your love for one another, because love covers a multitude of sins. One of the ways we love people is we don't repeat their faults. We don't repeat their failures. We don't constantly repeat their failings. Doesn't mean we ignore sin and say, oh, that's okay. Love covers a multitude of sins. It's always willing to give a person another chance, a fresh start. And a lot of people need a fresh start because they've got messed up lives. And if they come into the church, maybe they've been in jail. They come into the church, they're trying to get back on track, and they become defined in that group by the fact that they were in jail. Well, that basically effectively shuts down any new future for them, usually, because nobody will give, who's going to give them a chance? You're certainly not going to elect them to be treasurer of the church. You know, one of the things that Nicky Cruz, or David Wilkerson did when he went to work among the gangs in New York was he held youth meetings. And one of the things he did was he asked Nicky Cruz, who was one of the notorious gang leaders, if he would take up the offering. I hope you can appreciate that. Nicky was used to taking up offerings before, but keeping the money. But Nicky says in his book, Run Baby Run, he says that simple act by David Wilkerson of saying, Nicky, I want you to take up the offering. And of course, all the people in the crowd were like, why? You can't do this. This guy's he's a gangbanger. He's going to take the money and run. He said, but that simple act that somebody trusted me, it had been so many years since anyone trusted me. And he said that was the thing that really changed his life. And that's the thing about not bringing up things that are not proper to mention. Always you're mentoring people's pasts. You know, because we all have a past. We all have a past. You know, there's nobody here that doesn't have a past. So those are some other things that are bad, not to put them on the list. What's the corrective according to Paul here? What is Paul's corrective? Two reasons why you shouldn't put younger widows on the list. So what's the positive thing to do?
Get married and have babies.
Get married and have babies. You know. Now he uses here the word for commanding. This is this is what I want in the church. This is the pattern, the model that you need to follow. So do we encourage younger people to get married? What encouragement do we give younger people to get married? Any encouragement? How might we encourage younger people to get married? What advice would you give a single mom? Don't hang out the corner saloon, for one. Don't go looking for a good man at the local gin mill, right? You might give her counsel, places to avoid, you know. Or you might give her counsel on people you know who have character, that have eligible spouses that are good prospects, you know. One of the ministries of the church is to bring people together, to build strong families. Well, how do you do that? You bring people together, don't you? Create an atmosphere in which people can relate to one another. They can see this is a person with character. You know, this is a person who seems to fulfill his responsibilities here every Sunday. You know, that kind of thing. One of the ministries of the church is to counsel the youth, counsel the young people. We're going to have a camp next week. A lot of young people. Again, it's difficult for young people to make this decision. They need counsel. We forget that most of the world still has arranged marriages. People don't realize that's the case. We think that everybody just goes out and dates for a while and meets somebody. That's not the way it happens in most of the world. You think that happens in India? Over 1 billion people? Absolutely not. You think that happens in China? You don't marry anybody you want to marry. Mommy and daddy are there in that decision-making process. Why? Why is that a good model?
One thing, talking to girls that had arranged marriages in India, we were like, how does that work? Well, we trust our fathers. My father won't get out of the family. I know that.
Yeah. It's astounding.
How's it work for you guys? And we told them, they were like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. We see, we have the Las Vegas method in America, in the Western Europe, you know. You just take the dice and you roll them. Why is it important for families to be involved in this decision?
Someone
we're not getting ready to hang out a shingle here, Prairie View Church and Arranged Marriage Center. But
I think they're almost like what you said, they trust that we can see not the rose-colored glasses they're looking through.
I mean, when you're in love, love is blind. Yeah, you know, love is blind. Someone said it's also deaf and dumb, too. But the decisions you make under the influence of emotions, oftentimes they're not the best decisions. Somebody said, let your heart be your guide. What a crazy idea that is. Yeah? That's nuts. Most of the world still has arranged marriages. You see, the families, both families have a stake in this union. The country has a stake in this union. The world has a stake in this union. It doesn't help the world for families to be making broken marriages, this constant. Look at the wreckage all around us. It's killing us. It's killing us. Two-thirds of all the births in this country now are to basically unwed mothers. That's among the minorities. Among the white population, it's like 40 or 50%. You got to be a rocket scientist to know that a country that's doing that, you're not going to be a healthy country. You're certainly not going to be training people up to be good citizens. You know, and so this is important ministry for the church. The church needs to be giving those who have good marriages, giving the benefit of your counsel to the younger people. Having a younger person over for supper, and they ask you, how do you meet somebody nicer? These are some principles to follow. You know, these are some ways that you approach this. And again, that's a ministry of the church. Younger women to get married, to bear children, keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach. Have you ever thought about how important domestic life is? Because that's what he's talking about here, isn't it? How does the behaviors learned in a household, in a family, affect a family and a society and a church? What are some of the positive benefits of raising children? What kind of things are we teaching children in our homes? Well, what's one of the first things you teach kids in your home?
Discipline and gratitude.
No. What does gratitude teach you? Learning how to say thank you teaches us I have a connection to this other person. I have a relationship to them. I have a responsibility to them. Right? Somebody does something for you, you say thank you. It teaches me I'm connected to other people. It's one of the first lessons to learn. That's why we pray grace over the meal. Why? Because it reminds me I'm connected to God. And God provided something for me. I'm an indebted person. I have an obligation on me. Do you think people act differently when they know they have an obligation, a responsibility? What's the problem with kids today? Do they have any responsibilities? No, but what they do have is servants. Mom and dad, What is it you want, honey? Yeah, this, or do you want this? Here's 15 different choices. What you're doing when you give a child everything they want is you're preparing them for life in a luxury hotel. And is anybody going to live in a luxury hotel? Yeah. God engineered domestic life in such a way that these little bundles of energy and life that come into our life that are self-centered and sinful little beings are transformed into responsible citizens. How's that happen? Mom and dad teach them how to clean up the room. Teach them how to say yes and no, how to say please and thank you. How to respect their elders. See, God knew what he was doing was he engineered the family. How do we learn to be better people? How do we learn to be people and not wild animals? Not barnyard animals? How does that happen?
That's why you need a mom and a dad. Because the dad teaches more authority, and then the mom nurtures the whole time. You need teamwork.
You need authority, and you need nurture. You need the softness, but you also need the hardness. You need both. The mother has a built-in bias towards the child. Why? Well, because she carries the child. The child was a part of her. The father is always one step removed. The father is the first other that a child ever knows. The father is the first, oftentimes the first authority figure that a child knows. Now, mom's disciplined too. Dad's the simpler too. But when you lose that, that's why this thing of same-sex marriage, is this ain't going to work. It can't work. When we lose that, and that's what we're losing domestic life, and when you lose that, you essentially lose the country. Is there any future for a country that doesn't raise responsible children? No, there's no future. There's no future. There's no future for a nation with children that are irresponsible. So, again, what is the church's ministry? Well, it's to help build good families, strong families, you know. Now, this word for keep house, it doesn't just mean sweep the floors. This means to manage a household. It's a word that means be the manager of a household. I want her to manage a household. Has this thing of managing the household come up before in Timothy, 1 Timothy? What was one of the qualifications for an elder? He manages his health. 1 Timothy 3:4. He manages his household well. You know. How again? Can you think of one of the Ten Commandments that's fulfilled when children are trained up this way? Honor the father and the mother. Right? So, these are basic principles, but they're very important because the other thing they do is they build a strong society, a responsible society, but they also have they're an offensive weapon against who? Yeah. What does the devil look for? Yeah. Whenever there's a break in a family, whenever there's a break in relationship, wherever there's irresponsible behavior, rebellious behavior going on, a child who's rebellious is a good candidate to be used by other rebellious forces. One of the things you do to protect your children from demonic and satanic influence is just teach them to be a responsible person, that they have obligations, they can't do just whatever comes into their head, they got to think before they act. They need some impulse control. Where do we learn impulse control from?
From home.
I mean, my father told us, my taught me impulse control. If you don't stop bouncing that ball in the living room, I'm going to whale you. I'm going to tan your hide. You know, one of the great sins in our family was to call your brother or sister a jerk. You could get killed for doing that. If my father heard you say it, you were in trouble. You definitely were going to get a spanking. Even if your brother really was a jerk, but you're still going to get a spanking. He didn't like that word. He thought it was insulting, and we weren't allowed to insult. Now, we insulted each other plenty outside of my father's earshot, but why is it important to teach kids not to insult each other? Are you going to get a lot of promotions at work by going around insulting people? Yeah. See, impulse control. Parents teach that. Should teach it anyway. We have a society that whatever impulse I have, I must do. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter what it is. You know, if it feels good, do it. You know. Yeah, just think of how many lives have been ruined by pictures that have been posted on Facebook. I know an old lady. She was dating this guy. She's divorced. She was dating this guy. She really liked him a really lot, quite a bit. And she took a picture of him while he was sleeping in his underwear. She posted it on Facebook. How long do you think that relationship lasted after he found out that he was on the internet? It was over. Over. Finished. Now there's somebody with no impulse control. You know, we protect people. We're protecting our children when we teach them how to restrain some of these impulses, control themselves a little bit. You know, healthy emotional development, that's all part of this. Well, I sinned tonight. I didn't give you 5 minutes for questions. I'm sort of prattling on here, but we'll stop at this moment. Questions about this? Or questions about anything? Thoughts?